And it's time to get into Food on Friday. When trout and salmon farmer Mitch McRae lost $500,000 worth of uninsured fish in the Black Saturday bushfires of last year, he had to think laterally to keep his business literally afloat while he built his stock back up. So after netting, shoveling and burying tons of stinking fish, can you imagine doing that, Mitch turned to farming and marketing caviar, and it's done really well. And Mitch joins me now from Buxton in Victoria. Hi, Mitch.
G'day, Michael. How are you?
All right. You and trout go back a fair way, don't they?
Yes, yes. I've been playing with the trout we've been running the farm here for over 20 years and first worked here about 30 years ago. So, yeah, I've had a bit of a go with them.
What is it about Buxton that makes it such a good landscape for trout?
Nice cold water is probably the first prerequisite. There's only a few places in Australia where the rivers won't get too hot in the summer because as the water gets hotter, it holds less oxygen. And trout need plenty of cold water and lots of oxygen, and this is a good area for it.
Well, having said that,
85% of Australia's trout's grown within about a 40k radius of here.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Golly, that's a lot. So, talking about water temperature, you've actually seen some changes in that temperature since February the 7th. You better take us back to that Black Saturday first and tell us what happened.
Well, yeah, I suppose that on the night of the fire, that was what's killed our fish was the rise in the temperature of the water, first of all.
How far did it rise?
I didn't have a thermometer in the water, and we weren't able to, didn't have the forethought to take the temperature. But
it's a silly question, Mitch, I'm sorry.
No, but I know up at the government hatchery, which is about 40 or 50 k away, and the fire didn't actually get to them, but their water shot up about 4 or 5 degrees in the river there.
Is that enough to kill trout and salmon?
Yes, well, you see, the river was already pretty warm before the fire because we had that big heat wave. And once the river gets over 20 degrees, the fish start to stress. And if it gets up to about 25, they're going to die pretty quickly. And we're already up around the 20-degree mark because of the hot weather. And then as the front of the fire came through, everything just died.
Did it literally pass over the water?
The fire itself came up around my house first and then up around my ponds, but I've got a big tin fence around the actual production ponds, and it burnt the fence down and the power lines which were running my aerators to keep the fish alive. And then around the ponds was okay, but the fish, obviously the river got too hot and all the fish just started to keel over.
Did the house survive?
Yeah, we saved our house and most of our buildings. We lost a little bit of hatchery and equipment, but at the time our main focus was just keeping the house safe and the people safe.
And you actually were able to save some of the fish, weren't you?
Yeah, we out of about the 300,000 fish that were here, we saved about 10,000 little ones and about 1,000 yearling fish, which we decided we would make our brood stock because we figured they must be the super strain.
So they, yes, indeed. If you're talking about evolution, they're the big survivors, aren't they?
That's right.
So did you actually have enough time to plan for that saving, or was it just good luck?
Well, as I say, throughout the night, as the sort of fire was around, your first prerequisite was obviously to save the house and to keep the fires out, the spot fires out around the place. But there was a few people here. So most of those people, I put them onto putting the fire out, and then I tried to save the fish. We were running aerators to keep the fish alive, to keep the oxygen levels up. And whilst the power had gone out, I had a backup generator which was running. Mm. But as the front was on us and we got trapped inside the house, I could hear my generator running, but I could see the paddle wheels weren't spinning. And I couldn't get outside because the heat was just too intense. When I did get outside, I found a fence on fire, which the power lines were on, and it had melted the power lines out and tripped all my fuses. And so any sort of oxygenation I could do was gone. So then the fish just started to keel over very quickly then.
And then you had something round about 280,000 dead fish to deal with.
Yes, that's right. That by dawn, everything was floating up dead. You could see all the fish were dead. There was a few little ones that were just starting to keel over because the water went very black and oily with all the soot and debris coming down the river.
And that could have been a major ecological disaster if you'd left that fish in the water.
Oh, that's right. That was my concern. It wasn't like you could sit down and go, oh, wow, we've just had a huge fire come through. It was like, oh, wow, now we've got 40 ton of dead fish here in the river that they're just going to get putrid very quickly. And in Buxton itself, there was about 20 people left in the town, I think, who hadn't evacuated out of about 300 or 400 people. And a couple of them came over to me and said, you know, is there anything we can do to help? And I said, well, we've got to try and get all these fish out of the water pretty quick. We were blocked in with roadblocks and there was no communication or anything like that, so we had to sort of make it up as we went.
So you dug a hole?
Yeah, we found an excavator that was out on the highway trying to clear all the trees off the highway, and we said to the guy, can you please come in and dig us a big hole? We've got to get rid of these fish. And these couple of locals took off and came back with about 20 more, and luckily for me, I'm so grateful to them. We spent the next 4 days netting all the fish out, putting them into trailers and tipping them into these into one hole. Then we got another big hole dug a couple of days later because we'd filled that one.
And a year on, Mitch, with that hole covered over, those two holes covered over,
yep.
Is it growing on top? What's happening on top?
Well, everyone keeps telling me that they're going to grow a great veggie garden there, but I think it might take another year or so for it to break down. I reckon it's going to be pretty strong still. She was a fair brew.
I can imagine, yeah. Any smell permeating out through the soil?
No, fortunately, because we've got a mound on top of it. But we'll scrape it back and see what we can grow on it. Yeah, probably another year or so,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, take it easy, I reckon. Take it easy on that. In the meantime, you've forged ahead. A lot of people would have gone, that's it for me, I'm calling this quits. But you didn't. You've now sort of gone laterally. You've gone sideways into caviar. How do you do that?
Yeah, well, I guess, yeah, as you say, you know, you had a choice of either give up and go broke and, you know, wait for the bank to come and take your farm away and give up of 20 years' work or try and get back on top of things. And we knew that, you know, we had to get some fish back on the place as quick as possible. So we were able to source some fish from another farm that was coming up for sale.
Gee, that was lucky.
Away.
Yeah, that's really lucky.
Yeah, and so we put a few small fish back on the place, but we also have to sort of work on the principle that I'm not going to be able to grow the tonnage of fish that I was in the past. You know, 5 years ago we used to grow maybe 100 tonne of trout a year, and then the last few years between the droughts and the fire, our production's dropped right back in tonnage. So,
well, actually, that comes back to where we kind of began this fire conversation, because haven't you noticed since Black Saturday that the temperature of the water through the Stevenson River has gone up?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, first of all, the scientists, I sort of asked a lot of the scientists at the fisheries afterwards what, you know, what would happen with the river and what had happened in other areas. And they told me that, you know, over the winter months, you would get a lot of mudslides coming down the hills when there's rain, and which happened, and we had filthy water sometimes, just all mud and debris and silt.
Because we should explain to people there's no vegetation to hold it back.
No, that's right. All the way up, you know, 20 kilometres in every direction from me here at Buxton is burnt out, you know, very extremely. Everything's just fried.
So there's water turbidity to deal with?
That's right. And then they said, you know, and in the summer you'll find that the river may run hotter because there's no canopy over the river anymore. And sure enough, they're exactly right. You know, over the winter we got the dirty water. We were able to keep our fish alive through that because that was a bit of a risk, and some other farms weren't going to restock until, you know, a year down the track. But then once we hit January, we found that where it used to take a few 30-degree days to get the river up to 20 degrees and the fish a little bit stressed, it only takes a few 20-degree days. And so, yeah, the river's running just a few degrees warmer, which has caused us a lot of problems.
A bit of anxiety. So anyway, you've kept going and you've got this caviar business happening. Now, when I heard you were producing trout caviar, I must say some alarm bells rang, Mitch, because my image of caviar is that you get a sturgeon, you kill it, and then you pull out the eggs. You don't do that, do you?
No, you don't kill the fish at all. No, that's right.
You milk it.
Yeah, you milk the fish when they're fully ripe, and so the eggs come out loose. It's the same as if we were stripping the eggs out for fertilising as well, which we've bred our own trout here for years and years, so we're familiar with the techniques on
well,
how to
you
handle
may be. You may be, Mitch, but we're not. How do you milk a ripe trout?
Well, they come into season once a year, in usually here about early June, and you get the female fish, you net them out of the water, you hold them very gently, you give them a bit of a squeeze on the tummy and push down, and if they're ripe, all the eggs will spit out. So you hold a bucket underneath and you catch them.
I was joking about the fact you could take these trout live into parties and just, you know, just do a little sort of squirt onto a biscuit.
Straight caviar.
Straight onto the biscuit.
Yeah, well,
put, you know, bury them, put them back in water every now and then to keep them alive. You don't want to stress the fish.
Yeah.
But so seriously, you do that. You squeeze the tummy and
that's
out
right.
pops the eggs.
Yep.
And do you have to do anything in terms of refining before you jar them?
We do, yeah. We sterilise the eggs. We sanitise them in just some warm water just to make sure that, because it's a raw product.
Yep.
And then they're put into a slight pickling solution for, About 10 minutes or so.
Well, I've got some of the trout caviar here that you've sent to us.
Oh, good.
And I like it because it says on the label, as you look at the top, it says milk by hand. So I'm opening up your hand-milked eggs here.
Yep,
as I talk to you. Now, we've got a soft cheese. Is that what you'd recommend?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, caviar is usually eaten, you know, sort of on its own or just with a soft cheese on a biscuit or a blini or something. So, yeah.
All right. Well, I've got a bit of ABC Radio National Brie.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So, yeah, because we're Radio National, we don't have any blue vein. I've got the brie and I'm spooning a little bit of trout caviar. And, of course, the point of milking is that the trout survives.
Yeah, that's right. Once we strip the eggs out of the fish, we just gently put him back in the water. And
it's a she, isn't it?
This one. Get she'll it right. swim away, yeah.
All right. Okay, I'm just going to give it a go now. Here we go.
I can hear the crunch.
Mm. That's the biscuit, not the eggs, I hasten to add. Mm. It's really light in flavour, isn't it? It's not pungent at all.
No, they're not too overbearing, that's for sure.
Mm, that's fantastic. And how's the caviar business going?
Look, it's something we're still sort of experimenting with and working out ways to handle the product because it's a very sensitive product, caviar eggs, because you only strip them once a year, you've got to freeze them to sell them, you know, throughout the year.
Oh, that must be difficult because when you thaw out, doesn't that turn everything watery?
It can do, that's right. If they're not handled exactly right, you know, they expand a little bit in the containers. So if you fill up your container too much, they'll crush and they're very, very sensitive. So there's a few sort of techniques in handling them that we're still learning as we go.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to, you know, improve the product. And
Where's your market for this, Mitch?
We were starting to sell a lot through a lot of Japanese restaurants through their sushis and things. I've got a bloke coming to see me on Monday from an American distribution company, but I don't know how far we can go down the track with that.
You've got to guarantee supply, and if you're still working out your issues of freezing and thawing, that could be a bit of an issue, couldn't it?
Mm, yeah, that's right. So, as I say, we're still just got to fine-tune our whole system, but we think we've got a good product there to start with, and
because we can
control the whole process, we can maintain good quality.
Well, I'm spooning a few more eggs onto a biscuit now as we speak, and I'm just wondering, with a couple of minutes to go, can you sort of outline for us, go through for us as I munch away, your favourite caviar from trout recipe?
Well, I'm not a great cook, but as I say, I usually just have them fairly plain with cheese and biscuits. One of the Japanese chefs that I supply, he was doing the sushi in the nori rolls.
Yeah.
Which I think...
Amuse yourselves, by the way. Just keep talking.
Up.
Yeah, we're putting that recipe up, by the way, but just keep talking while I eat, would you?
Yeah. They're also nice on... I quite like them on smoked trout, actually. I just break off a piece of a fillet and put that on a biscuit, and I find it goes well with that.
Which is an all-of-fish experience, then, isn't it?
Oysters. Sorry?
I was saying it's an all-of-fish thing. You've got the eggs, you've got the trout, you've got the whole business, and you've got some from birth to death all in one plate.
That's right. And doing the whole lot on site where you do your own breeding of the fish, your own growing of the fish, your own processing on site, and then the value adding with the smoking and the caviar, it means you've got control from go to woe, and that therefore you can keep the quality up and make sure that no one mucks it up in the middle on you.
Well, very quickly, before I let you go, Mitch, I need to ask you, water quality, you've talked about what's coming down into the farm.
Yeah.
What's leaving the farm? Because a lot of people do worry about captive fish farms and what it does to water quality.
Sure. There was some concern about phosphorus loads and things like that. We're very strictly governed on what the amounts of phosphorus and ammonia that can end up coming out of the farm. I think we have about the lowest levels in the world on what we're allowed to add. We get labs come up from Melbourne 6 times a year, and they'll take a sample of our inflow and our outflow water and see what's being added in the way of phosphorus and ammonia. Nowadays, they've worked out the fish feeds are very efficient. We get nearly a one-to-one conversion of fish feed to fish weight, so you don't get too much waste come out of the fish at all now.
And well, good on you, and I do appreciate your time today, and congratulations on surviving and going forward with a new product, and it's yummy. Thank you very much.
No worries, Michael. Thanks very much for having me on.